Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
This is the Postmortem Podcast, and I'm Mick Garris. So, when did horror go mainstream? When I was a kid, I was the only one I knew who was into horror movies, books, comics, and television. Yeah, The Twilight Zone was popular in primetime on CBS, and ABC had The Outer Limits. They also had the horror comedy The Addams Family, and NBC had its counterpart, The Munsters. But I mean the real thing. Horror movies almost never played at my neighborhood theater. Once in a great while, I'd get one of the Corman Poe movies or Psycho at the drive-in, but it was hard to find true genre films and books in my wonder years. From the time I was traumatized in childhood by The Son of Kong, and throughout my adolescence and young adulthood, horror was a rare commodity. I would pore over the TV guide and circle anything that looked horrific, usually in the middle of the night, and most often marked melodramas, seemingly a code word for horror in that particular magazine. Saturday afternoons, there was Chiller Theater on Channel 11, Channel 5 ran all of the Universal classics, and once in a while, Channel 9 would play something darkish on their million-dollar movie all week long. But now, the most popular shows on television are about zombies and warrior tribes and dragons. HBO blazed trails with Tales from the Crypt way back when, and even my own Masters of Horror series allowed genre filmmakers unfiltered access to the airwaves. Stephen King is breaking box office records, and Godzilla is getting yet another big budget reboot. It is the best of times for a horror fan. We weren't popular kids in my formative years, but chances are this year's prom king and queen are well-versed in James Wan and The Walking Dead. It is a feast, unleashing a plethora of sequels and reboots and reimaginings. But the good news is this. We are everywhere you look, lurking in the cinemas and your TVs and your tablets, and we're not going anywhere. Horror may have its rise and fall in popularity, but it always comes back for more. And I'm glad to live in a time where almost any burst of dark imagination is accessible at my fingertips 24 hours a day. Speaking of reboots, writer-director Mike Dougherty is working on a new version of Godzilla King of the Monsters. But I first discovered his work with Trick or Treat, a terrific Halloween anthology film that is perfect for the season. And recently, I had a chance to chat with Dario Argento live at Beyond Fest at the American Cinematheque, and we're going to play excerpts from that conversation here on our little celebration of All Hallows Eve. You first started as doing sketching and painting, right? You're an artist before you started working in film.
Yeah, I started off as an illustrator and animator. Back in my day, I can't believe I'm saying this, but back in my day, we didn't.
I remember.
I'm reaching that level, I think. But the best film camera I had available was like the family Betacam camcorder. You know, which then advanced to become VHS and
big advance.
Yeah, they weren't the best resources. Like, we definitely didn't have HD cameras in our pockets. So I knew I could draw, and animation became the next logical step, because I figured that way I could learn how to make a film frame by frame at the very least. And it just sort of grew from there.
Was there a particular kind of film or animation or art that inspired you into this particular direction? Or have you chosen horror, or did horror choose you?
I think it was a mutual decision. horror definitely found me, and I definitely encouraged it. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and it was a golden age for horror because it was the beginning of cable television. Mm-hmm. And so much like, you know, streaming and the internet is all the rage now, and the way that that sort of creates this vast library of old movies and TV shows to find, so did cable. Because every studio and network was digging up old reruns, black and white monster movies, Godzilla movies, and just throwing them on cable for people to devour. And so I was the first generation, I think, to sort of have access to such a vast menu of titles to pick from. That, along with comic books, you know, cartoons. It was really a perfect storm of media to inspire: Stephen King books, Clive Barker. So it was a really good time.
So do you remember that first thing that captured your imagination that made you go, oh, I want to be a painter, or I want to paint this sort of things, or draw, or make movies, or write? Because you do all of these things.
I think it was a mix of things. It was, my grandmother had some old, books with really beautiful illustrations of fairy tales. And they were the original fairy tales, the darker versions. They weren't the Disney.
The Disneyfied
version. The Disneyfied, sanitized versions. These were the versions where the wicked stepsisters did cut off their toes to fit into the glass slipper. You know, this is the version where the big bad wolf did eat the grandmother at the end. So those were a huge influence on me growing up. But then that same Saturday, I'd be watching a Godzilla movie followed by, you know, Kung Fu and Universal monster movies. Mm-hmm. So it was a combination of, you know, offline analog stuff combined with cable television and VHS. That was also the beginning of the home video revolution. So the idea of getting to a copy of Alien from the library and being able to watch it over and over and over again, that happened a lot.
So where did you grow up?
Columbus, Ohio.
And were your parents artistic as well?
No, not so much. I mean, there was definitely some creative streak, in my father's side of the family. He used to draw when he was younger. And I think some of my aunts would sculpt and stuff, but nothing that really stood out. But they did encourage it. They saw that I could do something with a crayon and encouraged it. Much to the chagrin of my Catholic school nuns, who did not appreciate the illustrations that I added to the Bible.
The bloody parts. Yeah.
No, it was funny because I kept one of those grade school Bibles and I found an illustration of the fall of Jericho in it.
Wow.
And I added Godzilla. I had a tendency to add UFOs, Godzilla, monsters, aliens, anything to make the Bible a little bit more interesting.
Well, let's not go in order then. Let's get right to Godzilla. Now, obviously,
sure.
Godzilla has played a part in your life since the days of Catholic school and your Bibles. What was the attraction to him?
I think Godzilla works on multiple levels. You know, there's the obvious surface level of it's a giant monster destroying things. So that already is exciting enough and visceral enough. And especially if you throw two or more giant monsters in the same city beating the crap out of each other, it only makes it more enticing. And I think it works on that very sort of obvious level. But I like to say that I think Young would have a field day with the kaiju genre, because underneath all of that, underneath all the visceral thrills, you have the allegory. Mm-hmm. Of Godzilla and mm-hmm. the giant monsters. And when I was a kid, I was so obsessed with the character because they had the Saturday morning Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Oh, right.
Which definitely helped foster that love.
Was that where you were first exposed to Godzilla?
No, it was the old monster movies first.
Right. The original?
Yeah, the original.
The 1954? Yeah.
No, I went back. It's funny because cable, you know, they just showed whatever title they had available.
Right.
They
didn't throw it against the wall.
Yeah. You know, so I was introduced to the 70s films first, which were very vivid and colorful. And that was when Toho was purposely engineering the movies to cater to kids.
Right.
And so I started there and went back mm-hmm. to the black and white movie and worked my way back to King Kong and the Ray Harryhausen films. And it just became sort of this stew of the cartoon and the old movies and
where Godzilla is always battling some color.
Yeah. And, but what I loved is that as I researched the character more, I would go to the local library and there may be two books on the character. Mm-hmm. And the first book was this old kid's book about the making of the film.
Really?
Like black and white photos and very. It was sort of an analysis of the character and the film series. And, but it didn't shy away, even though it's a kid's book, clearly written for, 5 to 6 year olds. It explained how the character and the film series was created by the Japanese as an allegory for what they went through after having two atomic bombs dropped on them. That there was a very sort of serious, morose message being communicated through this very seemingly tongue-in-cheek giant monster story.
Although in the first movie, it's not at all tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
And most people have only seen the American version with the Raymond Burr sequences cut into it.
Yeah.
But Gojira, the original Japanese movie, is a really straightforward metaphor for World War II,
yeah.
which had happened, only 9 years before it concluded.
So. Yeah, and it's almost mournful in its tone.
Very.
It's not the knee slapper.
No, it's got a melancholy about it.
Exactly, which I loved. And I think that really made it matter to me as a kid. I understood its importance. It was the first time I learned that a film could have something to say, that a film doesn't always just have to be about entertainment value or blood and guts, that if you craft a film well, it works on multiple levels. And it was almost, I think what I really appreciated about it is that it was subversive.
Mm.
That it was sort of sneaking some nutritional value or some vitamins into your dessert. because who doesn't love Godzilla? But then it's like, when you know that, you then go back and look at the whole series, and even some of the goofier Godzilla films still had very clear environmental messages.
Right.
To it. But it allowed me to look at my favorite films, whether they be Star Wars or Alien, and try and see what other messages or ideas are being communicated here beyond just what we see on the surface.
Do you find that fantastic film offers a particularly unique opportunity to provide metaphor and allegory?
Yeah, I think it can. It's the perfect vehicle for that because it sort of disarms the conscious mind. You think you're just getting a story about, you're just getting a space opera about a bunch of misfits going off and fighting the Galactic Empire. Okay, fine, sure. Peel back some layers there, and you see a very potent metaphor for the Vietnam War. And Lucas has admitted that Star Wars was always political.
Oh, it's hard not to be. If there is a social strife particularly going on at any one time in our society, horror films are the first to reflect it.
Exactly.
Tobe Hooper didn't intend Texas Chainsaw necessarily as an allegory about Vietnam, but it's there.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
It's dripping from that film and the racism that's confronted in Night of the Living Dead.
Mm-hmm.
George Romero always said that his lead actor was Dwayne Jones was chosen because he was the best actor available, and there's never a single moment of reflecting that this is an African-American character.
Right.
Nobody mentions it.
Yeah.
But this is 1968, and a lot was going on.
Yeah, Ripley and Alien, same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's one of the most feminist of movies.
Exactly. And it really taught me, going back to Godzilla, that was the first film that taught me that you could have these layers, and you should. I mean, I think it's fine and dandy if you want to make a horror film just for the fun of it.
Sure.
Just for the learning experience, just for the visceral thrills of it. But if you can have something to say, science fiction and horror are the perfect vehicles for that. And I encourage people to do that.
Is that what draws you to the genre? And is this a particular interest of yours, or that's where you've ended up for now?
Horror?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I love it. I live it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just.
I mean, I know the feeling. But,
yeah, I know. I know you do. It's just. To me, there are very blurry lines between science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And sort of genre has just become the label for all of it, superheroes included, and you know, but then when you get into those genres, there are the subgenres. There's horror comedy, you know.
Ghost stories.
Exactly.
Zombies, yeah.
And I just love it all. I just truly love it all. I think they are our modern myths, and that they do reflect the very strange times that we live in. And that's probably why we're in such a golden age right now. Mm. You know, whether it be science fiction, fantasy, or horror, we can't get enough of it. I think because consciously and subconsciously, we're processing a lot right now.
Well, I want to move into your comic book work as well, and the comic book movies, the superhero movies. But continuing with the Godzilla thing, which I want to stick with for a while, how did that come about? There have been so many tries to reboot it, some more successful than others. Was this something that you championed from the beginning, or you found that it was being developed at a studio and said, I've got to do that. There's no more appropriate filmmaker for this movie than me.
It's funny. I mean, my first attempt at making a movie was a Godzilla movie.
Really?
You know, I mentioned earlier that my family had an old camcorder. And so the very first thing I did when I grabbed it was, I set it up on the ground and then took my Star Wars playsets, and figures and Hot Wheel cars. And then I just let my pet turtle stampede through this thing, playing music off to the side. You know, like that, the first instinct was like, how do I make a Godzilla movie or some kid version of a Godzilla movie?
Sorry, you're a little turtle.
Yeah,
as
exactly.
Godzilla.
Yeah. And it just kind of grew from there. And I even remember I went to NYU and I remember walking around New York City thinking for the very first time, having left Ohio and just being amongst all these skyscrapers and thinking, how cool would it be to make a modern day Godzilla film with all the visual effects that Jurassic Park had? Because Jurassic Park, I think I was a freshman just as Jurassic Park had come out.
Yeah, it's 93.
Yeah. And then I thought, well, gosh, it would be so neat to make that. And so I feel like the wish was asked for a long time ago.
Right.
And it's just been a steady progression since then. But the more recent developments were I had just finished doing Krampus for Legendary. And I was taking just a little bit of a break trying to figure out what's next. And I had dinner with Alex Garcia, one of the execs at the studio, and he very quietly said that Gareth Edwards wasn't going to be coming back, and he wanted to know if I had any interest in taking the helm. And I think I said yes before he could finish answering the question. And so that was about 2 years ago. And so it's been, the process of putting together the story. We did a writer's room, took about a year to work on the script.
Wow.
While also doing visual development at the same time. And I just finished shooting it a week ago.
Wow, you must be tired.
I'm very tired.
And now, did you, as an artist and as an illustrator, did you do illustrations and storyboards for yourself or designs for the Godzilla creature and all?
Doodles. I mean, I surrounded myself with such an amazing roster of creature designers and storyboard artists, and a very talented production designer named Scott Chambliss that every time I felt like I had to bust out my sketch pad, it turns out there was someone much better.
Yeah.
You know, like I can draw, but there are people who are much better than I am. And so I find that I tend to only bother if I feel like I have to. Although I do need to design some new monsters, for this one beyond our initial four.
Ah.
So chances are I'll be much more hands-on with the designs of those creatures.
And people should know about the website that shows a lot of your paintings and drawings and the like, which is, it's MichaelDougherty.com.
Yeah, it's just MikeDougherty.com.
Mike Dougherty.
I haven't updated it in years, so God knows what's there.
Well, there's a lot of really, really good stuff up there. And you're obviously a talented guy in many areas. But this is our Halloween show.
Mm-hmm.
And you've made an iconic Halloween movie that ironically never really got much of a theatrical release.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as it was released to Blu-ray and physical media, I mean, it became kind of a sensation. So tell me a little bit about your history with Halloween and how that led to Trick or Treat.
Similar to my love for Godzilla, it all started in childhood. My birthday is just a few days before the holiday.
Uh-huh.
So the birthday celebration and the Halloween celebrations all started to sort of blend in with each other, to the point where I was going ahead and celebrating it on Halloween, and then the birthday party involved trick-or-treating. So the whole month of October became a very special time of year, especially because the local TV stations started showing horror movies.
Right.
You know, every local station seemed like had Shocktober or something like that. So the whole month just became this time. It still is. I'm so happy it's October right now, where the whole world seems to finally regain its sanity and embrace horror and monsters and aliens and everything else. And my love for the holiday started to push me into learning about the history of the holiday. That seemed to be something I did a lot, was that there was something I loved, whether it be Godzilla, Halloween, UFOs, whatever. It always involved a trip to the library to sort of discover the untold truth of whatever that subject matter was. And so with Halloween, I very quickly learned about how it's a very real, magical holiday. You know, that it has very strange, mysterious, dark roots. You know, it's not just this night of the year where you go get some cheap plastic costumes from Rite Aid,
right,
and go out,
Coopers, yeah.
and go out and get a sugar high, much like, you know, a lot of our favorite genre stuff. It there's a deep, multi-layered history to it. And so that only made it more intriguing to find out that it really was this pagan high holiday that yeah. we've sort of adopted and transformed into a very kid-friendly commercial venture. Again, it was sort of like discovering the truth about Godzilla. It was like, whoa, there's something subversive here. Mm. There's something genuinely mysterious and supernatural happening here. So that just made me love it even more.
Right.
And that's only grown over the years.
Well, I know that when I was researching for Hocus Pocus,
mm-hmm.
I went back to Salem
yeah.
and discovered that there were, 10 to 11 day celebration there in this town that has more witches per capita than any other
right.
in the world, supposedly. A lot of them are new agey kind of crystal witches.
Yeah. They're real witches.
Yeah, yes.
Yes.
But going there and realizing here's this 10, 11 day celebration that climaxes on Halloween night with a candlelight vigil to Gallows Hill where the witches mm-hmm. were not hung, but were pressed to death in those days. So learning all of this, and then I went back like every year for 6 years just because I loved it.
Right. And it just makes everything cooler.
It is.
And yeah.
So now, you're getting a corner on the holiday horror market. next up, Trick or Treat. Well, first, let's talk about the anthology
yeah.
quality of that. Because the anthology movie has always been around to lesser and greater extent to have success.
Yeah.
And this one, tell me how you came up with the format and decided to do it in that way.
Well, I cheated. it was funny because the character of Sam, which is the sort of demonic trick-or-treater that wanders around between the different stories, he started off as an animated character that I did for a short film at NYU.
Uh-huh.
So he was essentially my senior thesis film.
Ah.
And like I mentioned before, I didn't have access to a lot of great live-action film equipment, so I went with animation just knowing that, well, I know I can do a lot of drawings one by one. I can make a film frame by frame. And so Sam became my first hand-drawn, full-color, animated.
Were these cell animations actually drew on paper?
Well, first you draw it on paper.
And then you
transfer it to cells.
Right.
So it's a very tedious process. It took 9 months to do a 3-minute animated film. And this is all before computers.
But you're talking 24 frames a second, so
yeah.
it's 24 drawings.
Well, you get away with 12 drawings.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you get a 12.
Or 90. If you're Hanna-Barbera, you get 3.
Right, yeah. keep in mind, this is all before computer animation. So this right. is all old school Disney hand-drawn animation. And so I did a short called Season's Greetings, and that's where Sam was introduced. And then that kind of became my calling card for a while. And one of the first people I ever sent the film to was Stan Winston.
Ah.
Because I was just a massive fan of his.
Sure.
Who wasn't. And surprisingly, he wrote back, or he reached out and said, saw the short, loved it. If you're ever in L.A., let me know.
Wow.
And I'd love to sit down and hear about what you want to do. And so I booked a flight to Los Angeles.
There you go. Right
I took
away.
Him up on the invitation. Wasn't going to let him squeeze out of this. and sat down, and he said, listen, you need to be making movies. because I was an animator at Nickelodeon at the time.
Ah,
and
okay.
Which was a great job for learning and income, but I was animating on Blue's Clues, which is, for someone of my taste, a bit mind-numbing.
Yeah. And your age.
Yeah. And so, and Stan was the one who really nudged me and said, no, you need to get out here. And he's like, you know, have you written a spec script yet? And I said, no, I haven't done that. And he goes, well, you should do that. And so what I did was I said, well, I love anthology horror movies. And this was late 90s. This is like 99. So the anthology was dead at that point.
Right.
I mean, you could not pitch an anthology as a movie or as a TV show without being laughed out of the room.
We experienced that with Masters of Horror.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just nobody, it was taboo. No one wanted to hear it. It was the A word.
Right.
And so I cheated. I took four short stories. Well, two short stories that I had written again in college as writing assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And they just happened to be set on Halloween night. And so I figured, well, if I have two, I can always write two additional ones.
Right.
And just set them on Halloween. And so I just took these four short stories, set them on Halloween night, smashed them together, and said, here's my spec script. And Stan was the first one to read that and say, there's really something here. I'd love to produce this.
That's great.
But the way he wanted to do it was traditional anthology, where you go out and get a director for each segment.
For each one, yeah.
And so he assembled, at the time, George Romero himself, John Carpenter, and who was our fourth?
Toby.
Hmm. It was Toby.
Yeah.
And
boy, what a lineup.
What a lineup, right?
Yeah.
Took it out. Nobody wanted to touch it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I remember the notes we got back from some of the studios. And one of the ones that stuck out with me was, this movie has vampires and werewolves, which are too old-fashioned. Nobody wants to see vampires or werewolves anymore.
Oh, obviously. Yeah.
You know? Right. And so I was mildly offended by that.
Good.
You know, because I was like, well, I want to see vampires and werewolves. Because this was when they were doing Scream knockoffs.
Right.
And that was all, the only kind of horror was being made was
jokey, tongue-in-cheek.
Teens. Yeah, young, with 20-somethings playing teenagers.
Self-referential.
Right. Being stalked by someone in a mask. You know, no supernatural horror was being made,
right,
for sure. But that setback allowed me the time to really continue working on the script. And then I also went and wrote a couple of Bryan Singer's movies. And that helped me learn about production because I had to be on set for those.
Ah.
And so by the time, because of that delay, I got more experience, enough experience that Legendary Warner Brothers said, hey, well, do you want to direct it? We still think that there's something to this script, but maybe this is meant for you to direct. So, you know,
nice.
A perceived setback became a really positive thing for me.
A great step for your career. You
know, yeah.
And a greenlit movie.
Yes. So it was a long road to get it made. It was a long road to then get it distributed.
Right. Was the plan to put it out theatrically when was in production?
Yeah.
And what happened? How did that turn into what became a video classic?
Gosh, I mean,
were there test screenings?
There's always test screenings.
Yeah.
it didn't have the best time in post-production.
Really?
Well, I mean, it's such a weird movie because it's an anthology film, which nobody wanted to make.
Right.
It's a horror comedy, again, which no one wanted to make. Had all these strikes going up against it. And so
it's schizophrenic in a good way.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the studio just didn't know what to do with it. The studio being Warner Brothers, the distribution studio. Legendary still supported it, you know, because they still believed in it, saw the potential for it. It just had a bit of an uphill battle because I think it was so quirky.
And I think Warner Brothers, of all the big studios, maybe cares the least or knows the least or has the least interest in horror despite it, but that was through New Line.
Right.
Even in my dealings with them, having written a couple of horror movies for them that never got made, they seem to be among the most conservative when it comes to the genre.
Well, they also have mostly moved into, you know, as a lot of studios have, into the tentpole world.
Right, the franchise.
Right. So, And the studio has changed a lot in the 10 years. This is, gosh, it's 10 years ago.
Wow.
We were going through this. Just gotten a couple more gray hairs.
and goosebumps.
Yes, yes. And so they were mostly focused on Harry Potter and right. those kinds of films at the time. So see, sometimes you have to remember that, you know, that studio might not want to distribute it because that takes valuable time and resources and manpower away from other films.
Sure.
Which might be more of a sure bet, you know, or more likely to have an effect on their bottom line, et cetera, et cetera.
And if it's not like a previous success, they're not quite sure how to yeah. do something with it.
But the thing is, I have no regrets. I hold no grudges about it because I do feel like the path that it took, the sort of meandering path where it became a film which really grew its audience via word of mouth, I feel like that was the best path for it.
Well, isn't that the best way for any movie anyway, is through word of mouth? If your audience embraces it, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because there is something to know. There's something to knowing that people who come up and say that they've seen it and they love it, that it's that they're being honest and sincere, because it's not that you can buy your success.
Right.
But there are plenty of films which come out, horror or otherwise, which have huge opening weekends, you know, or make a bunch of money at the box office. But then once they end up on home video, they're sort of never heard from again.
Yeah.
You know, that there's no shelf life
right.
to them.
This started on the shelf.
It started on the shelf. So. And it's managed to become this perennial. And I do wonder, had it gone theatrical and let's say it did come out in 2000 theaters or whatever, and maybe it ended up not doing that well that year
yeah.
and then ended up not having this home video afterlife. You know, the reality that we entered is the one that I'm actually more comfortable. I would not go back and change a thing. I would not go back and ask for, a theatrical release because I have enjoyed watching it find its legs on home video and become this cult title.
And we genre guys are used to being the underdog too,
right? Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of something that bonds us. I mean, it's when we have these Masters of Horror dinners, everybody's supportive of each other. And it's like, you've got a movie coming out this weekend. That's great. I can't wait. There's none of that, you know, Schadenfreude that
right.
happens throughout Hollywood. There really is a great support system. And we are the gutter snipes, you know?
Well, I think you have a good point. Like, the other thing that I think we're aware of is that it's a long road, and that just because a film isn't successful initially doesn't mean that it's not going to find its audience over time. A lot of my favorite films were commercial disappointments when they first came out, but then decades later, they've become these classics, one of which we're getting a sequel to this weekend, Blade Runner.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
how many years did that take?
Like, that was considered a commercial disappointment. Yeah. I remember at the time, even though I was just a kid, people said, oh, it's so boring.
Yeah, the reviews were pretty mixed.
Yeah, yeah. Same thing with The Thing.
Yeah,
you know,
and I did publicity on The Thing and the making of The Thing. And
you know better than anybody of that.
Well, you know, I did the same for E.T. Mm-hmm. at the same time, the same year, the same studio. And E.T. was what the world wanted at that time. And The Thing, you know, I literally remember telling John Carpenter when it came out and it did not do well at all,
mm-hmm.
saying, I'll bet you 10, 20 years from now, people are going to be talking about this movie as
yep.
a classic.
Yep.
Because it was groundbreaking. Which is a great thing to become a classic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it really is something that sticks in your heart after seeing something.
Literally. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's a perfect example of that sort of long shelf life. And that's really sort of guided me in my career is I don't care about awards at all.
Oh, in this like, genre, you better not.
Well, yeah. Like negative interest in awards.
Yeah.
And, you know, I respect the box office, and I understand that it's very important to our industry, obviously.
Well, and validation of any kind
sure,
is possible.
Fine. But what really matters to me and how I try to choose my projects is whether or not this is a film that people will want to watch 10 years from now, 20 years from now, because that sort of long-term shelf life is so much more appealing to me than immediate short-term success.
Well, let's talk about that. Do you actually, when you're making a film, are you thinking of it having that shelf life? Because movies and television and media in general are so much of the moment and an expression of the society at that time.
I try. I think there are, I don't have any sort of hard set rules, but I do try to make it as timeless as possible. So I try to avoid dialogue or situations that will seem dated
right
in a month.
And
a
once
year.
You've got an iPhone X in there, you're pegging yourself.
Well, by the way, so it's like the way that I try to portray technology in the films I do is very minimal. Mm-hmm. You know, or very sort of general and vague. It's like hairstyles or catchphrases. You know, there are certain things which can lock your film into a time period and then it'll seem dated. Technology being a huge one. The hard part right. of technology is that we have to use it. We have to embrace right. it. But
it's a story point.
It changes it? So fast.
Yeah. Well, nothing more illustrative of that than the 80s being represented by shoulder pads and big hair.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. There's certain things you'll never be able to avoid. But even with Godzilla, for example, I encouraged my costume designer, my production designer, even the hair and makeup people. I said, sort of look at everything, say, from the mid-50s up till now, and what are sort of the common design elements, whether it be the outfits or the hairstyles or whatever, that are truly timeless.
Right. Simple.
And simple and classic and will probably still be simple and classic and timeless 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. And so that became a fun exercise for everybody involved to try and find, whether it be props, furniture, clothes, what have you, that that sort of had this timeless appeal.
Well, while we're on the subject of holiday horror, mm-hmm. you moved on to Krampus. Now, this is based on an actual European legend that mm-hmm. the U.S. audience is not very familiar with. Tell me how you first became familiar with Krampus, Christmas horror.
Well, I think like a lot of horror fans, November 1st is a very dark day. You know, it's everything that
it's over.
But yeah, it's I hit a wall, and you know, as much as I try to avoid it, it's just it's a sad day. The pumpkins are rotting out on the front porch, and I you know, it's funny because I killed some time in some stores before coming over here, and they already had the Christmas crap up. You know, and the Halloween stuff was already on sale in the corner.
Oh,
and it
ouch.
Just didn't feel right. It always felt like Christmas was constantly stepping on Halloween's turf.
Ah, okay.
And personally, as a kid, I was always a little bit, I think like a lot of kids, a little bit terrified of Santa Claus. Mm. Because even the Santa Claus myth, forget Krampus, the Santa Claus myth by itself is terrifying. Mm. You know, the idea that you're constantly being watched and surveilled by this fat man in the Arctic and his elves who, and they're going to judge whether or not you deserve getting toys or not. I mean, that's dark. And the idea that we use that to manipulate our children is dark.
And did you ever, were you ever placed as a child on a Santa's lap
yes.
in the shopping center?
And I have photos of myself as a kid screaming my head off. You know, it's just this weird thing that our culture has embraced. Really, our culture has manufactured and then embraced, because the Santa Claus that we know and love is really
a Coca-Cola
product. And so it just, again, much like Halloween or Godzilla, something about Christmas didn't sit right with me. Mm-hmm. And I also went to a Catholic school, so I learned all about sort of the religious elements of the holiday. So back to the library I went, and then lo and behold, it turns out Christmas is a pagan holiday. You know, like everything goes back to the pagans and the witches, because those are the guys who knew how to do it right, you know. And it was the winter solstice, and the Christmas holiday that everyone rallies around in our modern society is something we created to sort of counteract and warp that holiday mm-hmm. and turn it into a Christian holiday. But the original Christmas, as it were, the winter solstice celebration, was just as dark and weird and mysterious as Halloween. Mm-hmm. You know, that it had its own cast of witches and ghosts and
Samhain.
And forest spirits. Mm-hmm. And kind of was a borderline scary holiday, because it was meant to be a celebration to sort of counteract the cold, dark winter.
Right.
And so we looked into sort of the ancient Christmas myths and stories. They all sort of led to Krampus. Mm-hmm. And there are even some theories that Santa Claus was purposely created to counteract the figure of Krampus.
Tell us what Krampus represents.
I mean, to me personally, or what mythology?
Well,
I
both mean, the mythology and what you were presenting in this.
I mean, to me, it's a character that, you know, again, working on multiple levels, like for kids, is meant to encourage kids to behave and not be such little shits throughout the year, you know, because it's like if you misbehave, you talk back to your parents, here's this ancient monster that will emerge from his lair and come grab you and haul you away to hell. I mean,
so be good, Jeff.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's these scare tactics. But I think, if you really look at the mythological significance of the character, of what it really means, it's, you know, using the holidays sort of as a reflecting period. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like using the quiet and the stillness of winter to sort of, you know, reevaluate your life, your situation, the people around you, and be grateful for what you do have, knowing that death is right around the corner. It could potentially take anyone at any point in time. So, I mean, those are my favorite sort of mythological archetypes, are the ones who on the surface level are just something fun and weird, whether it be Krampus, Godzilla, or Samhain from Halloween. Right. But underneath all that is a whole smorgasbord of weird psychological turmoil and significance.
And so what was your approach when you decided, was this something you pitched to do a Krampus movie, or a studio was going to make a Krampus movie? Tell me its evolution, how it came to be.
I got together with a couple writer friends of mine, Todd Casey and Zach Shields, and it was, he was circulating, you know, he was kind of floating around in a zeitgeist quite a bit, making appearances on Family Guy. I think The Daily Show had a segment on him. It just felt like every time Christmas rolled around, there were more and more articles or news stories about who is Krampus. And so it sensed like, okay, here's an archetype which is clawing his way into our reality, much like one of the old gods, and who wanted to be embraced. And so I said, you know, someone's going to make a movie about this character, so it should be us. And it just kind of grew from there. The idea of making it sort of a classic, what felt like could be a classic Christmas movie that then gets invaded by a horror movie. Mm-hmm. That was always the agenda. You know, that if you just watch the first 20 minutes thinking that it's a straight Christmas movie and no one told you otherwise, you would be completely on board. And then all of a sudden something happens where...
And there's a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the kid doesn't...
Christmas with a monster.
Well, the kid doesn't mail his letter to Santa, which is, you know, he tears it up and throws out the window, so someone else gets summoned. So we wanted to make something subversive and fun. Something really, the goal was to make a Christmas movie.
Right.
That was, had horror elements in it.
Which is automatically subversive.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So you had written big movies that had gotten huge theatrical release and the like, but this was your second movie and it mm-hmm. was your first one to get a theatrical. Mm-hmm. And it was very well received critically. So what was the feeling? How, you know, this was a big change. Yeah, you'd gone through as the writer, but this was your own movie from conception through execution.
It felt great. It
yeah.
felt great. I mean, because, you know, for what you just said, is that it wasn't a script that a studio was developing and then brought us on board. It's just something that was hatched in my living room, essentially, and doodled on cocktail napkins at, you know, Hollywood bars while trying to crack the story. We would sit there and kick ideas around. I'd be sitting there sketching the creature on a napkin or on a set of index cards or something like that. It was a homegrown passion project. And so to have it take a similar path as Trick or Treat, but to finally cross that finish line really felt like a win.
So how long was it from conception to release?
2 years.
And what was the first audience screening that you sat through? Tell me what your experience was.
It was the one that you were at. at the Silent Movie Theater. Is it La Brea or Fairfax? I've been away for
it's
so
on
long.
Fairfax.
On Fairfax,
yeah.
Yes. I've been away for so long.
And it was packed.
It was packed, and the response was fantastic. And that was the first time I had gotten to show the finished film.
I didn't realize
to
that.
An audience.
Wow.
And it was probably the best screening we had. Like, I didn't, a lot of times I like to go to the theaters after release and watch it with an audience or feel the reaction, but I knew that the reaction was never going to be better than the one that we got at the Silent Movie Theater.
Yeah. Well, that was an amazing night.
It was.
And
fun.
I was really glad to have been there.
It was Black Friday.
That's right.
It was Black Friday. We screened on Black Friday.
Awesome.
Yeah. Appropriate.
Completely. So let's talk a little about the world of comic books. As someone who paints, draws, did you want to do comic books when you were in your formative years?
No. I knew I was not going to be drawing comic books. I loved comic books. I still do. But for whatever reason, I knew it was just meant to be there as a muse and not so much as a career choice. I think because I actually don't enjoy drawing sequential art.
Ah, so it's just a piece.
Yeah, which sounds weird being an animator.
Yeah.
But an animator is different because you actually see the drawings come to life. Because you flip the pages like a flip book and you can see your character dance and move across the page. But like, for instance, I don't enjoy storyboarding. In the same way that I don't enjoy doing comic book art, but I love doing animation.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, well, my father had trained at art school, but mm-hmm. never was able to make a living doing that. And the first thing I did was draw, and what I wanted to do was make animated cartoons.
Huh.
That was the thing that really got me excited until I started to write.
Ah.
And writing had me give up drawing completely at a very early age. Mm. And, you know, the direction I ended up going was similar to the direction you went. But the world of comic books, I loved comics when I was a kid. But the superhero stuff was my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something that I was fascinated by in comics, but not so much in movies.
Hmm.
So tell me how you got involved. You wrote two X-Men movies and Superman Returns. They were all Bryan Singer movies.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that start for you?
It goes back to Trick or Treat again, because that was my spec script.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first landed in L.A., the calling card was Season's Greetings, the animated short. And then the companion piece to that became the Trick or Treat spec script. You know, at NYU, you were always taught, okay, if you're going to go out to L.A., just be armed with a spec script and a short film or something just to show that you have the capability of creating something, you know, from beginning, middle, to end on your own,
right.
You know, from your own passions. And so I made sure that I had that. And so and this was just after X-Men 1 had come out, which I didn't have anything to do with.
Right.
But Brian had read Trick or Treat just as a spec, just as sort of to give advice on the script.
Mm-hmm.
And then
and Brian's also a big horror fan.
He hasn't made
that many horror.
No, he loves horror and science fiction and, you know, all of the genre. I keep encouraging him. He needs to do a horror film,
mm-hmm.
something like Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. He liked it enough that when he needed a new writer on X2, he suggested that myself and my writing partner Dan Harris come on board to do the rewrites, because they had a couple drafts done by the prior writers, but they were departing the project and they still needed more work done. And Dan and I had started working together. Our first writing job was Urban Legends 3.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Another franchise.
I know, right? But it was the first... Again, I was an animator at the time,
mm-hmm.
and here comes Phoenix Pictures saying, hey, we read your Trick or Treat spec script. We don't want to make it, but would you like a job writing the direct-to-video sequel to Urban Legends? And so, again, I was an animator. I was like, yeah, sure.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. And Dan and I went and pitched on that project and got the job. It became our first writing job, pretty much paid at scale.
Right.
But it was fun.
Which is fine.
It was fun because what we pitched was like, well, let's move away from the serial killer urban legends and into the supernatural realm. And so Brian knew that we were you know, now professional employed writers. And so he said, hey, can you read the X2 script? Give us some notes. And I want to see if I can bring you on to do some quick rewrites. And what initially started as quick rewrites turned into, okay, we're flying you to Vancouver to be on set every day during pre-production, all the way through post, call to wrap.
And you know how rare that is for a writer to be on the set.
I didn't know at the time. I was really naive at the time. And I assumed that all movies had their writers on set. Only to get back and to, you know, finally go to my first WGA meeting and where I explained that I'd just gotten back from set. And they're like, what do you mean? We're, what? Right.
That's the Writers Guild of America, for
yeah.
those who don't know.
It was the best boot camp in the world was to be on the set of an X-Men movie surrounded by this amazing cast. And at the time, it was sort of like Karate Kid, where I didn't understand, like, why do I have to be there at call? You know, like, I'm not a morning person.
That's a very good question, by the way.
Yeah. But the way that Brian liked to work is he wants to block the scene and rehearse it with the actors. And if something doesn't sound right, he wants it rewritten. And so it was like being a fireman who was there to put out a script fire every day. And there were a lot, you know, where, and you learned that just because you write it on the page doesn't mean it's going to work when the actors actually start saying it. And, learned a lot, absorbed a lot through osmosis of how a set works.
Right.
And then that just kind of grew from there.
Well, it led to another X-Men movie and it led to Superman Returns. But tell me about your experience with these giant franchises for major studios, the writer is often the most expendable person on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the process like? I mean, were you deluged with notes and different approaches and things the studio wanted to re-guide? And how did that work for you?
Well, we formed a little think tank between Brian, myself, Dan. We kind of create this insulated hub where, you know, we would get notes from the studio or whoever and sort of talk amongst ourselves about, okay, well, how do we incorporate this note? Is this note actually improving things or not? But we remained open because if there was something he taught us is that a good idea can come from anyone at any point in time. And I know it's popular to bitch and moan about studio notes, but they can be very helpful. And oftentimes it's not about the note, it's about how you address the note.
And they can see it from the outside looking in.
It's always a fresh pair of eyes, yeah. You know? And so we were bombarded a lot, but we had a really good method and system of working together to figure out, okay, what's the best solution whenever a problem arose.
And so now back to Godzilla. you wrote, co-wrote and directed mm-hmm. Godzilla. And so you're the guy in charge.
Yep.
And so in the creative process there, being more in control, I mean, this had to be a very different experience than Krampus because of the scope and size of this.
Yeah, it was different.
Creature.
Yeah, it's funny. It's different, but it's also strangely the same in a lot of ways. Because much like Krampus, it was an ensemble cast. The pressures, which you're very familiar with, of time, schedule, resources, it's the same, just amplified.
Hmm.
The schedule was twice as long, so that was different. But again, I think had I not gone through the X-Men and Superman machines, I wouldn't have been as prepared as I was, because those shoots were over 100 days each. Godzilla,
wow.
We had 70 days.
That's
so
pretty big.
Yeah, so, you know, my first two movies, I was used to these 102, 110 day schedules.
Where you're shooting 5 pages a day. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And here you're shooting a page and a half to
yeah.
2 pages a day.
So it was, I wasn't completely unprepared. There's always adjustments to be made. And yes, Krampus was, and Trick or Treat were much smaller films, but in some ways it felt like a natural progression.
Well, we have a few questions from the Twitter audience and we'll get to that right after this. Podcast One has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Postmortem with Mick Garris, through the all-new Podcast One app, available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other fans of the show. You can even create your own polls to debate your favorite horror films. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360 video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play. So we do have fan questions, and just to let you know, you can reach us on Twitter at PostmortemMG, one word, on Instagram at PostmortemGram. And you can see all of my Postmortem TV shows, the old Z Channel shows, the making ofs, free audiobooks and things at MickGarrisInterviews.com. So, Mike, Cody asks, how did it feel to have your movies become part of Universal's Halloween Horror Nights?
Oh, good question. I almost forgot about that. I mean, it feels amazing. Last year, they had a Krampus house at Universal Hollywood. And that was surreal because they are so detail-oriented that they even had the smell of gingerbread.
Wow.
In the air when you walked through.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was just neat because it was Krampus, and then right next to it was Nightmare on Elm Street and The Exorcist and Halloween, and it's like winning an award. And then this year, Universal Orlando has Trick or Treat as sort of like an outdoor scare zone.
Cool.
But same thing, where it's just, there's, you know, there's actors dressed up as your characters wandering around in costume. It's like this dark, twisted version of Disneyland in my head.
Well, speaking of Trick or Treat, a lot of people asked, what is the status of Trick or Treat 2?
Oh, God.
Sorry.
No.
When 37 people asked the question.
I was wondering if it was going to come up.
Yeah.
My hope is that once Godzilla has been put to rest, that I can dive back into it. I mean, I'm hoping it's currently the first week of October, so obviously my mind is drifting back to it. But I would love to finish writing it in post-production, and then I'd love to make it my next project, but we'll see.
One last question. Sammy asks, I've heard there is a secret connection between Sam from Trick or Treat and Krampus. Is this true?
The films have certain common elements, which I don't know if anyone has found them all.
The Doherty universe?
Well, they're in my mind, two ancient deities who protect these quasi-mystical holidays would probably exist in the same universe and maybe get a drink and swap stories between holidays. And in the film, there are certain threads that connect them if you pay attention.
Now, more Postmortem with Mick Garris.
I want to thank Mike Doherty once again for being a part of our special Halloween podcast on Postmortem. You know, a few nights ago, I had the pleasure of having a conversation at Beyond Fest at the American Cinematheque in Hollywood with the great Italian master of horror, Dario Argento. We intended that to be an entire episode of Postmortem, but there were technical difficulties that made that impossible. The recording quality was not good. We had a lot of severe distortion and the like. But we have salvaged a few minutes because we didn't want to pass up this historic opportunity to share some of that conversation. So here are a few highlights from that night. I had the pleasure of working with you twice on Masters of Horror, and that was such a wonderful experience, and watching you work and the detail with which you work and working with the actors, and you rewrote the script yourself and tightened it up. And it was fascinating to watch how economically you work. You know what you're doing when you come in, and you're ready to go, and you want everybody to move at your speed. Tell me how you put that together. The script was written by the actor Steven Weber, who played the lead. You cut a lot of the jokes out.
No, I changed something because it was written by another. I'm not used to working the screenplay written by some other people. Usually I write the film for myself. And then I rewrote this, but it was not bad, but light.
But light. Now, one of the things that's interesting, this was based on a creepy comic book that was drawn.
Yes, it was good. The comic was very good. It inspired me a lot for shooting a film.
In fact, you used some of the panels as storyboards on the set.
Yes.
Your father was a film producer and your mother was a photographer, so you were born into the arts.
Yes.
So did you feel that filmmaking was what you wanted to do from a very early age? It wasn't painting or photography?
No. My purpose was not to be a film director, to be a writer maybe. And then a critic, film critic. He was the Trump. And I started to write films for other people, like the Once Upon a Time in the West with Sergio Leone.
Which also one of your co-writers was Bernardo Bertolucci.
Bernardo, yes.
A couple of names you might have heard.
Yes. And then after the film is a coincidence maybe, but after the film with Sergio Leone, we start to do film successful. Me and Bernardo, we are big friends. We are very young. We choose this semi-debutant people. Very brave.
Well, you made the transition pretty quickly in 1969 to directing and writing The Bird with the Crystal Plumage.
Yes.
So could you describe to us what giallo means?
This is sometimes people to do this question. Every time I'm very embarrassed. Giallo is something like a little bit mystery, but with the important, the psychoanalysis is important to go inside the psychology of the character. And also the women are important, women, female, young, old, every kind of woman. I work with Jennifer Connelly. She was 13. Phenomena, yes. And this is the giallo. Giallo is with female and important character, mystery a little bit, and something reflect your personal. And put this like throughout on the screen. What? Yes, I throughout all my bad things in my stomach to the screen. What?
Then so you vomited your.
People watch this my moment.
So you made three movies that are considered giallo, which I guess would be a combination of crime and psychology and eroticism. But you with
erotic and female important character.
Very stylish.
Yes.
Mario, tell me about your casting process. I've sat in on some of the casting sessions for Jennifer and for Pelz. And tell me how you like to work with actors, how you discover that it's somebody you want to work with.
Something is like an instinct. I follow my instinct. I don't want to do the test, speak about. No, I have a conversation and I follow my instinct. I like this person. It's okay for my film. It's simple.
Well, what were the films and the filmmakers that really inspired you and made you want to make movies?
This is a long story because I was the critic before I was clinical, I stood in France for 1 year. I discovered in France the American, the American French Cinematheque. We have, at the time, it was very important. We have every projection, every day, many kind of films, silent, old, new. Was from discovered like a joke for the children. It's marvelous to stay and on the seat and watch film different and discover the expressionism. I discovered the many things. The first film of Ingmar Bergman, marvelous. The first film of the Nouvelle Vague also. Influenced a lot. The film of the American 40-50, you know, sex victims, seventh victim, and
the Al Wooten film?
Yes, the Jacques Tourneur also disappeared. Nobody will speak about it. Jacques Tourneur was
people and seventh victims.
Yes, people and other films. Was a great person.
He also did a lot of film noir. Were you also inspired by film noir of that era?
Yes. And they say Jacques Tourneur was one of these, maybe the most important. And somebody in the audience wanted to ask something. Yeah?
Hi, I want to know at what point in the creation process music plays a part.
The question is, what the importance of music playing a part in Dario's film?
I start to think of music during writing. And scene I write, I discover some music in my mind. This occasion, I have a terrible lesson from Ennio Morricone. He was my first musician for the game. Ennio was, he lives close to me, and I shoot the Verdi with Tristan Plumage, and I have a meeting with him, it was emotional, and then I choose from my disc, you know, some with music were the thinking in my mind that was good for the film. The disc, I go to him and get my disc. And he was in a big studio and close to piano. And he watched me, with eight like an animal because he saw my disc. It is. What you have this? See, disc. Maybe you have some inspiration. I'm inspired for myself. He says, but not the others. No. Put. No. I don't want to see you. No, sorry, maestro. Sorry. Okay. Okay. You speak about it. This is. First encounter with the music, and then I worked with many people, Bill Wyman from Rolling Stones,
Keith Emerson,
and the Goblin. Big friend, and also he do this music. It was for me the best of.
Is there something that you haven't done yet that you really want to? Something in the world of film that you, a genre you have not done yet?
No. There is somebody want to ask?
Yes. Dario had worked with George Romero. Over the course of the years, and what were his thoughts about working with
you? Yes, was First of all, was my best friend. The best things are my best friend and my brother in films. We do some complicated relation at the beginning, because when we met, he had an idea to do a film, Dawn of the Dead, it's the sequel of the Night of the Living Dead. He came in Rome, he write the film in Rome, close to my house. I helped for the moment, some moment, to write this film. And then he started to shooting. I was close to him for some week. Then we have two versions of the film. At the beginning, George don't like the version I do there. But after he agreed. He says it's a little bit different, but good too. Okay, thank you. because we have another music, etc. And then we do another films together with the Blue Evil Eyes. We do that film together in Pittsburgh. It was great. It was marvelous to do a film with George. And then we still big friend. This year we have the departure of people, unbelievable. Toby Hooper, Wes Craven, lots of people, marvelous director, disappeared. Okay, this is the life.
A couple more questions from the audience, right here. I see a sharing of references with Ryan Pollock, whose film Phantom of the Paradise you just watched. Tonight's film, Suspiria, also shares Jessica Harper. I noticed there's a lot of scenes in both your movies throughout your careers that sort of handshake each other, sort of reference each other.
There are references of Brian De Palma films to your films and back and forth, cross references, visual references, film style references between your films and Brian De Palma's films. Is that something he invented or, or that is an actual thing? Did you have a creative relationship with De Palma?
I don't know De Palma. I never met him. I never met him. Yes. Sometimes I see some scene of mine in these films. It's okay. It's good because also I stole some scene from the expression from Fritz Lang because this is our world of movies. But I saw some scene of my these films. Okay, good. If you like, okay, I am happy.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.